It never does to deride the knowledge of the past, because someday our own knowledge will be the knowledge of the past.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Lord of America!
People hear about Loch Ness and everything. It's some kind of unique thing. But it isn't really unique at all. That's the whole point. And especially for people who are listening across the United States and part of Canada, they've got to realize that, of course, you don't have to go to Loch Ness or to Africa or whatever to actually look for lake monsters. They're actually probably somewhere nearby to you. There seem, in fact, to be several kinds. This is the thing that people have to get out of their minds, I think, that we're dealing with one kind of animal all the time. There are clearly variations of these creatures. But that's a debate for another day. I'm not getting into that.
Yeah, that's probably an understatement for sure, yeah.
That's outside my comfort zone.
Ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 9. On this edition of the program, very excited about this conversation we're about to have, because as I was just saying to our guest, it covers two realms, in a way, of the esoteric. We're going to be looking at the lake monsters phenomenon, which is a topic we haven't covered yet on the program before. And equally exciting to that is that we're going to be talking to Peter Costello, who wrote a pioneering book on lake monsters way back in 1974, titled In Search of Lake Monsters. It really is a seminal classic in the realm of cryptozoology books and paranormal books, really, in general. And thankfully, through our good friends at Anomalous Books, In Search of Lake Monsters is being reissued now for the modern audience, over 40 years since its original publication. And Peter has been very gracious enough to come on the program, discuss the book, discuss lake monsters, and we've been trying to get this conversation going for a couple of months now. He is all the way over in Ireland, and I am here, obviously, in the United States. And between the springtime and the time difference and all that stuff, it's been nearly impossible to schedule something. But finally, today, we're going to sit down and talk to Peter Costello about In Search of Lake Monsters and sort of those days back in the 70s when he was doing all this work and put out the book in the first place, and how cryptozoology itself has changed over the years. So I'm very excited about this conversation. Have been looking forward to it for quite some time. Welcome to the program, Peter, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be able to talk to you and to your audience.
I think it's going to be a really fun and enlightening conversation. Now, we like to start things out. This is kind of a little bit different here in a way because, you know, your bio background kind of contains a lot of the research into the lake monsters. So we don't want to go too much into the bio background, but tell people a little bit about who is Peter Costello. What's that?
Well, as you were just saying, I currently live in Ireland, and I was born, and I went to school there, but I also my family emigrated to America, so I went to an American university. I'm a graduate of the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, where my father was an academic. So I lived in America and then lived in other countries as well. So there's a lot of personal background in the sense of this, but this is only one of my interests. But unfortunately, this was the interest that in a way that started earliest when I was in my teens. You were just saying, research in the 70s. Well, the research, to tell the truth, actually went back 10 years before that, as research does, to the early 1960s. Mm. At that time, when I was still at school, we pick up these enthusiasms in our teens, I think, and you know something, they never let us go. We may think they have let us go, but they're still there donkey's years later.
Mm.
And I can see, sort of looking through this book again, that there are references to Jules Verne and Conan Doyle. who are people that I later wrote biographies of. So, you know, we become what we are in our teens, I think, whatever we're told by psychologists. So at that time in the 1960s, there was a very famous incident at Loch Ness, where Tim Dinsdale, an aeronautical engineer, managed to take a film. Now, this was the first time for many years that actually anything had been really done at Loch Ness in a serious way. And this got on a major news program on the BBC, and there was much talked about. And Tim Dinsdale wrote a series of books, and that was what really captured my interest.
Hmm.
But from that then, I also went on to read Bernard Heuvelmans, the man who's now the Belgian zoologist, who's called the father of cryptozoology. And it's really back to Bernard's sort of wide-ranging research into all kinds of mysterious animals, but also especially into marine animals, that actually went into some of stimulated my research. And the other thing was we had a houseboat, as many people in America do. We had a boat on the river system in Ireland and on the lakes, on the Shannon. There were reports of lake monsters in lakes I knew very well in Loch Ree and Loch Derg. And you can't be in places like that without trying to look into it. So once you start collecting the stories begin to mount up. So the Loch Ness was Loch Ness I read the books on, and then I researched the Irish lakes. And then when I also did some research into Scandinavian lakes in Norway and Sweden. And then, of course, when we emigrated to America, when I should have been really studying English literature at the University of Michigan, I was actually as often as not to be found in the microfilm library using back copies of the New York Times in search of monsters.
Yeah.
So it actually began to build up a kind of worldwide dimension, which is what is in the book. And I think that's very often a thing that's overlooked, because people hear about Loch Ness and everything. It's some kind of unique thing. But it isn't really unique at all. That's the whole point. And especially for people who are listening to across the United States and part of Canada, they've got to realize that, of course, you don't have to go to Loch Ness to Africa or wherever to actually look for lake monsters. They're actually probably somewhere nearby to you. And if you go back, you were talking about the history. If you go back in time in the United States, we'll talk about it for a minute. The first reports of sea serpents in the New England coast go back to very early colonial times, to the 17th century. And then you have, they was a great big mass of them in the early part of the 19th century. But then as the colonies moved westward, the course of empire, so to speak, moved westward into the Great Lakes, and then beyond that into the mountains, the Rocky Mountains. There were lake monsters reported in the Great Lakes, and then in a whole chain of the lakes that are in the Rocky Mountains, probably, right down from sort of the Lake Okanagan up in British Columbia, right down to California. So that's the thing. In America, the Americans have a great opportunity, I think, to not only to investigate the past monsters, but in fact to investigate the current monsters. So
absolutely, yeah. Okay, so that's kind of the bio background. What I think is amazing, it should be pointed out too, like we mentioned here, I mean, this is all this sort of, all this research you were doing was in the, you know, between the mid 60s to the mid 70s, prior to the publication of the book. It's just tremendous. I can see why it's a seminal classic in a way, because back then it had to be nearly impossible to gather the sort of information unless you were doing the legwork that you were doing. You know, you were luckily in the United States, so you could do that, and
well,
you had a foot in Europe, so you could kind of, you know, that's why the book is tremendous, because it combines all these. It's a global book, which would be exceedingly difficult
actually,
in that time of
maybe easier a bit now in the internet age to do some kinds of research, but I still think from sort of a spot checking on what can be available, for instance, on the Library of Congress newspaper site, there's still a lot more material to be found out there. And it looks as though it might be easier to do it, but when you actually find these historical reports, you then have to, of course, investigate the background to them and so on. But certainly the internet age and the digital age has made things easier in one way. However, it's also made it more difficult in another way, because with Photoshop and God knows what.
All those
pranksters that are out in cyberspace are also at work. So, you know, things have got easier in one way and suddenly got more difficult in another way. So
absolutely, yeah. Now talk a little bit about Bernard Hovelmans. I'm sure I butchered that name. I feel like I got it close, though, so maybe not. But Bernard Hovelmans, you said, you know, the father of modern cryptozoology,
well,
your father, you know.
He was actually a Belgian who was settled in Paris, and he had started out as a scientist who then took up scientific journalism. But he became particularly interested in the whole question of whether there were unknown animals still to be found at large in the world. And his research was actually initially inspired by Ivan T. Sanderson, whose name would be familiar, mm-hmm. I expect, to many, many of your listeners. A man with a great range of interests one way or another, with whom Bernard at a later stage was involved in bringing to public attention the mysterious Minnesota Iceman. But that's another day's work, I think, mm-hmm. to discuss. But anyway, Bernard published a very seminal book in 1955 in French called On the Track of Unknown Animals, which was translated into English in 1958 and scored a huge success. And it revealed in the preface to the English edition, Gerald Durrell, the writer, was sort of saying that he'd often thought he would like to do a book like that, but when he saw the amount of work that Bernard had done, he just realized he hadn't even scratched the surface, that Bernard had really explored it in far greater depth. And he just simply showed people what was being reported, what was there, what had been found, and he put it into a whole new dimension. But it was a dimension that was created by a reputable and fully qualified zoologist. So it actually had great clout, in a way that a lot of the writings about this question of are there sea serpents, are there mysterious animals, and whatever, didn't have before. It gave it that kind of scientific concrete foundations from which a great deal flowed afterwards one way or another, and it still continues on in sort of the work of people like Lauren Coleman and Jerome Clark and people like of that kind. But he went on to write a long series of books, not only about the unknown animals generally, but then about the sea serpent and the giant squid, and then about mysterious animals in Africa, and some of which were a very long time getting into English, but which are probably now not quite as well read, widely read as they ought to be. And of course, once the system started going and people realized there was something to be investigated, a lot of people piled in.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
By the middle of the 70s, there was quite a new enthusiasm about the whole question of whether there were creatures in Loch Ness. Which is when the book was published in 1974, just shortly afterwards, and the paperback edition came out, there was a great deal of publicity that was given to a series of photographs by that had been taken in Loch Ness by the Ryan's editor and team and what they showed, and that was a great build up to that. And then I think a lot of the press were disappointed. One of the things that plays into all of this is the reaction of the press about things. If people read the actual reports and material, you get a very different impression than what you often get when you actually read a popular article about it in the press. You know, the press is often not very, it tends to make fun sometimes of these things, which of course you and your listeners will be familiar with.
Yeah, absolutely.
To deride and make fun of things you don't fully understand, rather than actually patiently investigate them. The investigation is the bit that's hard work.
Exactly.
Well, Berger's book took from 1940-45 to 19, right to the end of his life in the 80s. So, and sort of 10 years or more of work went into my book. So, you know, don't think it's all going to get done in 6 weeks.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Well, it's interesting, you know, it's, you say, you know, he was inspired by Ivan T. Sanderson. It's like just remarkable when you think about it, because nowadays there's just, you can't go too far in paranormal circles without tripping over a cryptozoologist. But this was like back in the day when, you know, there really wasn't even that term. It was like such a raw early field. It's remarkable to think about, you know, like your book. It brought all this stuff to the surface for so many people for the first time. It's amazing.
Well, I think too that one of the things is that it's also brought to the surface a lot of sort of rubbish, but which is inevitable because Lauren Coleman mentions in his introduction about how there was sort of a lot of popular paperbacks which really didn't always do the subject much good, or cryptozoology. But I think that the people who persisted in it, say like Lauren again, have sort of laid aside a vast amount of research, which I think is hardly ever absorbed in a way. I mean, it's to read it all would be like reading the literature about ghosts. It's just beyond anybody to do. One has to concentrate on a small part of it. But then when you concentrate on the small part of it, you may actually be missing something essential somewhere else.
Mm.
And I think that was one of the things that I was trying to do, that rather than write another book, as I say in my own preface about Loch Ness, I wanted to actually give it the larger worldwide dimension. And for instance, Loch Ness in Scotland isn't actually a unique there either. There are lots of reports from other Highland, Scottish Highland lakes, which are less well known, but they also go back in time. The earliest reports of Loch Ness go back to late Celtic times, to an Irish saint in 560 AD. But, you know, there were reports throughout the Victorian period, the 19th century, about lake monsters in Scottish lakes. But they didn't actually take off until the 1930s, when the newspapers sort of seized upon it in a new kind of way.
Mm.
But by making Loch Ness so famous, they then distracted everybody's attention from other reports, not only in North America, as I say, but South America, Africa, Australia, Asia, you know, all around the world.
Right, right. Yeah, Loch Ness kind of cast a shadow over the whole idea of lake monsters, and in turn, you know, it's kind of like a rising tide lifts all ships. So if people are really into Loch Ness, they're going to be a little bit more interested in some of these other topics. But, you know, nowadays Loch Ness is kind of fallen by the wayside of the big paranormal stories. And in turn, you can kind of see that lake monsters also are kind of, you know, easily taking a backseat to like Bigfoot, as the sort of primary, mystery of cryptozoology, it seems.
Well, I think this may be due to a sort of American dominance of the media. Maybe if you've got a large population and a large continent, you can certainly generate a lot of material that will sort of overwhelm everybody else. But then the whole point about the question of as we'll just say Sasquatches, the interest in them derived in a way out of work that had been done even by Bernard Habermas on the Yeti in the Himalayas, and then on other creatures in Central Asia. So again, that's as Ivan Sanderson pointed out in his book about the unknown hominids, that has a worldwide dimension as well.
Mm, absolutely.
It's just not North America. It's right across the European, Asian, and North American landmass, but also perhaps in parts of Africa, and also maybe even down in Australia. And one of the exciting things was, I mean, these miniature people that were found in the the island of Flores.
Yeah.
They're exactly described in Bernard Haberman's book, The Little Men. And it is one of the things that seems very strange to me, how the scientific discovery is made and nobody credits the background research that was done by Bernard. It just showed exactly what could happen when the groundwork was laid, and he traced the whole history of these small hominids right back into the time of Prester John and earlier. So, you know, you have to bear in mind all the time that there's a past history and a worldwide dimension to it all.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, if you were to, I mean, you obviously looked at this lake monsters phenomenon for a very, very, very long time. If you were to sort of like venture a guess, what's your idea of sort of how many we're talking about as far as how many lakes or bodies of water, maybe exclude, I guess, lake monsters. Yeah, we're not going to talk about you know what I mean.
They're not necessarily going to be everywhere. In the book, the point is made that these creatures that we're talking about seem to be, mostly found in steep sloped mountain lakes. Now that you find this in Norway, in Sweden, in Scotland, in parts of right through the, as I say, the Rocky Mountains. But also as well, they must be related in some way, as Bernard pointed out, and as is quite clear that we're talking about the same kind of creatures as have been reported for thousands of years in the sea. They were talking about sea serpents. Now, the problem about it is that when you get an idea of that word serpent, people say, oh, well, that must mean that it's a reptile. Now, the thing is, of course, that they because these animals move through the water with a sinuous motion, they look as though they're like a snake, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they are snakes or reptiles at all. And this kind of putting a name on something has actually sort of confused the issue, because essentially my theory is that these animals are actually mammals. They're sort of long-necked seals. Now, that doesn't, the most popular theory is, of course, that they were surviving plesiosaurs as long-necked dinosaurs from the great age of reptiles, with a sort of past million-year history. But the problem people have to remember is that the environment consists of ecological niches, and to survive in a particular kind of ecological niche, an animal needs perhaps a certain appearance or a certain shape, and the plesiosaurus was filling an ecological niche in the age of the reptiles that would now be filled by a similarly shaped mammal-like creature. So it's actually quite biologically sound in a way. But the thing about it is that this obviously relates to the long-necked sea serpents, of which there seem, in fact, to be several kinds. This is the thing that people have to get out of their minds, I think, that we're dealing with one kind of animal all the time. There are clearly variations of these creatures. And the other thing is that there may not all the lake monsters may, in fact, be mammals. I mean, in South America, people are... In 1922, now, in one of the chapters in my book is called The Patagonian Plesiosaurus. In 1922, there was a scientific expedition went off into the Andes searching for a Patagonian Plesiosaurus. That had been reported in a lake, but it turned out, in fact, that there had been previous reports, and there were reports in there up into the 1960s when my book was written. And now there's a whole tourist industry built around the Patagonian Plesiosaurus. Now reports are still continuing. So I'm not sure that it is a Plesiosaurus, but it's now been nicknamed that. But I think that a lot of people also would still like to think that they're a surviving prehistoric monster. That's actually what feeds into some of when you see illustrations in newspapers, not by people who have seen these creatures, but by artists who were employed, cartoonists as much as illustrators, they tried to give them a kind of, you know, dinosaur-like look, which they perhaps are a little less terrifying than people might imagine. But just encountering any very large creature in unexpected circumstances is going to be a very terrifying experience for people.
Absolutely. Let me ask you this. What the argument, I guess, that a lot of people have about these lake monsters is that the, and I'm sure that, you know, in the pantheon of lake monsters that you've looked at, the size of the lakes differ from very large to not quite large.
Yes.
But the idea is that they couldn't really sustain a population within an isolated lake. What's your take on that argument?
This is the thing. It's how isolated some of the lakes are. Now, the point is, for instance, Loch Ness isn't really an isolated, just to take that as an example, isn't really an isolated lake. There's a river, the River Ness flows out into the North Sea, and when you get down to the southern part of the lake, it then the river, which is now sort of slightly canalized, but it flows on down into Loch Oik and to other lakes and right down through a chain of lakes that eventually gets down to the sea again on the other side. And in the west of Ireland, for instance, some of the monsters that have been reported seem to be sort of living in sort of puddles in the middle of bogs. And yet those puddles are actually associated with lake systems that actually do eventually get out into the sea. And so it may well be that what looks like an isolated lake isn't an isolated lake in quite the sense that people understand it to be.
Right.
Now, of course, you have to make some allowance for people seeing things that aren't there, too, in the sense that people mistake quite natural phenomena like wave patterns or floating logs or other things. There must be some reports, certain number of reports are going to be down to people being mistaken in what they've actually seen. One has to admit that. And one also has to put in a small amount to say that there always are going to be hoaxers somewhere or other. And then there are people who say things are hoaxes, and I'm not sure they may turn out not to be hoaxes. I mean, there's a controversy going on about one of the most celebrated photographs of the Loch Ness Monster, the so-called surgeon's photograph.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which now is sort of said to have been concocted by two people. But one of the problems about that is that the original story was that it had been taken by a well-known in London surgeon.
Right.
While he was on holiday in the north of Scotland, and he'd borrowed a camera from a friend to take photographs of trains. And when he took the photographs, he took the photographs, which were then on old-fashioned glass plate negatives, which you can't get now. He took them into a chemist shop in Inverness and had the chemist develop them. And two of them were blank, and one of them showed the famous picture of the long neck that got into the paper. And the other photograph, which never got into the paper, was kept by the chemist, and showed the head of the animal sort of just disappearing down into the water, sinking down into the water, not a long neck, but just going under the water. And that only came to light in the 50s. And it doesn't seem to be built into this story. But the surgeon who actually, he's always called the surgeon, who took this picture, he was actually a well-known scientist who gave evidence in forensic cases in for the police. And it's absolutely unimaginable that a man of that kind would be involved in a hoax. So actually, I must say that what actually may be misleading is the claim that it's a hoax, because which everybody seems to accept now, and I'm not sure that I do. I accept myself at all. I much prefer to think that the surgeon's photograph is actually, our photographs are actually genuine. But there you are. You see, there's an endless debate into the actual immediate circumstances, how something was taken, how it was developed, how it was passed to the press, and the reputation of the person who took it, and his professional standing, and the damage that would have been done to him if he had been associated with the hoax, and so on. All of that has to be taken into consideration. So it's quite a complicated thing. I mean, it's like if you were to, if there are thousands and thousands of reports of lake monsters, each one could become a forensic case in itself, you know, to with witness statements and responses and analysis and whatever. So it's quite a complicated thing. There's going to be no instant answer to any of these things.
Oh no, absolutely. It's that's why it remains such a great mystery. And it was funny you're talking about the surgeon's photo. The way you described it, sort of the different aspects of how to investigate it. It sounds just so eerily similar to the Patterson-Gimlin film. You know, it's like, how did this happen? Who was behind it? How did it make it into the press? It's like it's something that's going to be endlessly debated and sort of poured. The details are going to be poured over, you know, forever, because no one's ever really going to know for sure about either one of these pieces of evidence.
That's very similar. Except I think that the Kenneth Wilson, the surgeon who took the photograph, was a man of high professional standing. In a way that some of the people who've taken Bigfoot films perhaps haven't been. But
no,
that's a debate for another day. I'm not getting into that.
Yeah, that's
I'm
probably an understatement
that
for sure. Yeah,
that's outside my comfort zone.
Well, I was going to say, you know, you've seen it from a different perspective, because this thing exploded sort of as In Search of Lake Monsters came out in the 70s. But nowadays, I don't know, Loch Ness, you know, I'm 35. I grew up like in the 80s. I remember those, I don't know if they had these in Ireland, but they had like these Time Life book commercials, like Mysteries of the Universe, and it would sort of name all these different, things that were kind of like the tent poles
of
the paranormal.
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
And Loch Ness was always in there, but nowadays here in 2015, it's like the Loch Ness monster's really fallen way down the, you know, the depth chart, I guess you could say, of paranormal mysteries. It's like not really as popular as it was in the 70s. I guess, what do you make of the downturn in popularity for the Loch Ness mystery?
Well,
and in turn, lake monsters in general, you know?
The thing has actually changed in a sense that one of the things, and this is a sort of difficult area to discuss is, you had, for instance, Ted Holliday, who'd done a lot of research on lake monsters, and then slowly moved from a theory that they were some kind of animate object, animal. Now, he didn't want them to be a mammal, or he wanted them to be some other kind of prehistoric animal. The problem about it was he began then to actually begin to see that there was some kind of relationship between UFOs and lake monsters. This kind of, it was a kind of run-in of one phenomenon to another. And one of his last books was called The Dragon and the Disc. And so that actually each, it isn't, these things are not being kept in separate compartments. They're sort of, at their boundaries, they melt into each other in a way. And, you know, maybe one of the things that has somewhat disappointed me over the decades since the book was published is that one would have expected we might have had some kind of strong zoological breakthrough that would have solved this mystery. And it's a bit like with the Bigfoot as well, and the Yeti. We never seem to get that biological breakthrough. And you begin to wonder whether there isn't something to be seen in a theory that begins to explore more these kind of other edges to the matter, that maybe there's a I'm not fully worked up my ideas about this into a book form, but one feels that one would like to see at the end of my book there was a chapter devoted to sort of the idea of folklore and legend and history. Basically, we'll just call it, in quotes, ghostly phenomena. Now, maybe this is the what Ted Holliday, I think, referred to it as the Goblin Universe. So that's an element that perhaps has a tremendous appeal to lots of people, and takes one over into the edge of the truly paranormal. That's one of the things that I think adds to the paranormal is spread out into all kinds of areas, and the lake monsters have, as you say, sort of gone down the train a bit, because actually they the potentially kind of human image, we'll say, of the Yeti and the Sasquatch makes them actually much more incredibly interesting to people in a way, because they feel they're encountering some kind of quasi-human entity. Whereas in the Loch Ness Monster, it's a bit like, it's a sort of more akin to people encountering sort of dragons from the remote past. But God knows there's enough dragons at large in lots of modern films to keep people interested in dragons for a long time too. So, maybe these things will go in fashions as well, and there'll suddenly be a return of an interest in dragons. Though, mind you, most of the films about Loch Ness and about lake monsters, I think, generally have been a great disappointment. But however, that's yours isn't a show devoted to film criticism. I do think that we perhaps need to enlarge our ideas maybe a little bit. Certainly Bernard Hovmans was very keen on there only being a kind of, a material animal solution. And I mentioned much earlier how he and Ivan Sanderson had become involved in the Minnesota Iceman. Well, I was in correspondence with Bernard had come over to, America to publicize his book on the Great Sea Serpent, and he was staying with Ivan T. Sanderson when this all blew up, and I had sort of letters from a whole stream of correspondence from him at the time. And at a later stage, he was sort of, when he was back in France, he was sort of saying that he found it actually a bit difficult, because he found Ivan sort of was much more prepared to explore sort of much more esoteric ideas, we'll say, and when they were discussing the origin of the Minnesota Iceman might have come from, Bernard told me that one of the things that Ivan said to him quite seriously, he said this quite seriously, we have to consider too that it might be an alien entity. But that was back in the sort of 1968. And I think we've had a full flood of alien entities of one kind or another. But you can see how these two streams of thought, they don't always coalesce very easily with each other. And Bernard sort of became very uneasy about all of that. And when he actually wrote up the book, he wrote it up with Boris Portnoy, who was a Russian, who wanted to see these creatures as a survival of Neanderthal man. Rather than a sort of, we'll just say an alien entity. But then at a later stage, when Ivan Sanderson died, he died of a brain tumor, Bernard thought that, oh, maybe this was sort of, these strange ideas that Ivan was having were due to promptings of the incipient tumor. It's all very, not really. You can see the way that Ivan Sanderson's ideas developed, but they were quite widespread in a way about various other subjects. And I don't think that was really the solution. It's just Ivan was exploring somewhere that Bernard didn't want to go.
Right. That's what I was going to ask you. Was it like, because you mentioned sort of at the end of your book, you sort of entertain the idea of maybe of some kind of folkloric ghostly phenomenon. Was the idea of these things being paranormal rather than flesh and blood, was that like so far, I mean, even today, sort of the consideration of cryptids being paranormal is pushed to the edge. Was it like even further beyond the realm of thought? Like, it makes
well,
it sound like that from how
at
Bernard
that stage,
reacted.
It certainly was. I gained the impression from what I see in the literature now that it would certainly probably be more entertained by certain numbers of writers. But there is the problem with this. In a sense, is that, as I was explaining, if one goes down that road, you're basically going to alienate sort of large elements of the scientific community who might be otherwise very helpful in assisting one to find unknown animals. So that there's a penalty to be paid for pursuing sort of that kind of theorizing too far, in the sense that an important critical dimension would be lost to researchers by them simply not having the feedback from the biological zoological community. Do that sort of that makes sense, I think, in a way that you have to keep, one has to keep sort of one foot on the ground, so to speak, or at least even if it's a big foot, or one paddle in the water. You can't actually just completely accept one theory. And we don't actually, in a way, understand things very well. I mean, it's, you know, only a couple of weeks ago, there was a week when it was reported that a 30-foot Morar eel had been sort of captured off the coast of Devon, and in the same week there was a giant crab-like creature had been found, and then another report of a giant squid. The giant Morar off the coast of Devon reminded me immediately of some creature that was reported off the coast of Wicklow here in Ireland in Charles Gould's book about monsters, published in the 1860s. So, you know, you've got to, it was, you know, one has to know what the background material is to be able to place what happens. That's just enough to say, oh, we've seen a creature now, and we have a photograph of it, and we pulled it out of the water. But it has a whole history behind it, and you have to try and go back then and try and find how long these creatures were known in time before, in earlier centuries. Mm. Some of the people who wrote about mysterious animals in an African dimension, like the British colonialist administrator Pitman, he sort of discusses in one of his books, he has two chapters devoted to the mysterious animals of Africa, and he tries to work out this confusion between the real animals, surviving animals from prehistoric past that have survived, and this whole question of then the dimensions of sort of African folklore that have then imposed themselves somewhere into the same mix. And it can be very hard to kind of weave away among all of these different elements. But this is actually one of the reasons why research in a way in this field is so essential. We need more people in it, perhaps. Hmm. And maybe I was saying earlier that there's so many lakes in North America that you know, it's people should be actually researching their local lakes and trying to find that not only the reports from say the early 20th century but also the 19th century, and then what's the folklore of what I continue to call Indians, but I suppose I should call the First Nations if I'm to have the right vocabulary for modern American radio.
Native Americans is fine. I was just going to jump in here to sort of set you up with that question, because that's what I was going to ask you. You know, you mentioned earlier as the colonialists, for lack of a better term, spread across America, so did the lake monster reports and sightings and stories. But what do we know about Native American tales of lake monsters that predate
This is the thing. For instance, I came to notice roughly at the time in the wake of the first reports from Loch Ness was Lake Okanagan in British Columbia, which is a very long lake, and it's in a valley that where they do a lot of they do a lot of fruit growing and whatever. It's a very sort of, in a way, but it's up in the mountains, but an attractive climate. But when the first colonists who arrived there in the 1860s, they certainly found that the local Indian communities knew all about these creatures, which they called Natika, and also along the seacoast of Vancouver northwards, the tribes that were on the seashore, they knew all about sea serpents and these lake monsters. There is an immense amount of folklore, which it seems to me is a bit underestimated in a way. And I think that if you go back, for instance, to Lake Champlain, nearer the east coast, That certainly had an Indian tradition. But mind you, in that case, it's got confused because the earliest report that's often quoted for Lake Champlain, that it was Champlain himself, is a mistake. But there were, in fact, Indian traditions among the Seven Nations about these creatures, and they'd even come into Hiawatha to some extent. So this is an important dimension. But it needs to be, I think, almost approached from the inside, because as with Mr. Pittman in Africa, the outsider doesn't see the inside of a culture in quite the same way that the insider does. It's possibly a thing for the members of the Indian tribes themselves to research and to bring forward their own kind of vision of the mythological past of North America. But the same applies in Africa to some extent, because Africa is going through this great process of both destruction and modernization, which is seemingly on one hand destroying traditions and yet extraordinarily reinforcing traditions, because the rise of what's sort of really foolishly called witchcraft in modern Africa, which is really a reinsertion of ancient traditions.
Right.
That's the insideness of all of that is very difficult for people from Europe to actually ever appreciate or to understand.
Mm, I see what you're saying.
About
the
same sort of confusions you have, for instance, over what people in Haiti believe and what voodoo is all about, and what, you know, so the things from the outside get sensationalized, whereas from the inside they may have a coherence and a relevance and a tradition and some kind of explanation would be available, which would actually fully more illuminate what was actually going on.
Hmm. Now, is there, obviously the book came out over 40 years ago, is there anything in the book now looking back that you're like, oh, I shouldn't have put this in there, or this doesn't fit, or I have a second thoughts about this case,
no,
or anything
you,
like that?
Looking over it, which I was doing again for preparation for this talk, I should have written more about that. The problem about it is the years since I write a lot of other kinds of books. I write literary history as well, and literary biography. So I mean, my research techniques have improved. You know? I would now say, God, how did I neglect not to do that? And in fact, it's one of the daunting things, but if I were to set out in the book would now grow to about four times the size that it is. I mean, it's already sort of nearly 400 pages long. What is it, 348 pages? You know, it would have just gone bigger and bigger. And I don't think there's anything I would have left out, to tell you the truth.
Huh.
I just feel there's more I should have put in.
That's great. That's a great attitude.
I mean, one of the things when this new edition came out from Anomalous Press, we discussed this as to whether it should in fact be updated. And the position of the publisher and of Lauren Coleman, who provides the introduction, was no, reprint it as it is, because as a classic statement of how it was seen at that time. And I think that was a sound idea. Because otherwise you'd have to condense earlier material and reduce it, whereas now all you need to do is add on to it. That's the point. You don't want to lose detail from the past.
Exactly.
One of the things is, I mean, arising from the writing the new material for it, I mentioned in the course of it that there were still in the course of the original edition, there were things that I hadn't solved. And there was a Victorian reference to an article by a British statesman called Lord Malmesbury, who said that another British aristocrat called Lord Ellesmere had written a very interesting article about the monsters in Loch Assent. Well, the thing about that was I could never then track this down at that date at all. It just simply completely defeated me. But lo and behold, after a bit of further digging on the internet, up pops what I had been looking for those years before. a very remarkable report indeed, going back to the 1850s, which quotes the sighting of an animal that came ashore on an island in Loch Assynt, and it names the two gamekeepers that saw it and whatever. You know, so quite stunning. If at the time it had been followed up, it would have been interesting. But as I say, all I would want to put in all this material I wasn't able to find back in the 1960s and 70s. Why does it strike you that there's something in it that I should be ashamed of having written?
No. Don't do that to me now.
The problem about it is that you know, you just simply learn more. And it's one of the things I notice in writing biographies. You know, I with a colleague, I wrote a very large 500-page book, a biography, not of James Joyce now, but of James Joyce's father. But I realize now writing long biographies isn't really the solution to understanding people, because really the solution to sort of biographical mysteries is to concentrate on a smaller period of time or a particular episode that you can write about in great detail. The trouble about large-scale overviews or long biographies or full-scale biographies is that you still have to compress detail and leave things out. And even when the writer is finished, his editor will say, "Oh, I think we can do with that less about the first wife and, you know, whatever."
Yeah.
And so things that have been researched get lost, whereas they wouldn't get lost if one could break the thing down into, say, "Oh, we'll just write about those two important years in his life and write about it in great detail." And actually, I think that's the way biography ought to go, and history too. And I think also that's the way that cryptozoological studies ought to go. It needs to concentrate on individual areas or individual episodes or whatever, and go into them in as great a detail as possible.
I see what you're saying. So almost like take a chapter from each of these, take a chapter from your book here, and each chapter, I guess, could be its own book, is kind of like what you're saying.
Well, that's basically what it could be turned into. And in fact, to some extent, I mean, for instance, the one about, I was writing about Australia and New Zealand. Well, of course, now there are people who write about cryptozoology in those countries in great detail, and they're off in pursuit of the Yowie and this and the Bunyip and whatever,
right,
in high style. So you know, this has actually, a book like this, because it's a general survey, opens up the possibility of research to people in a way they wouldn't have thought of doing in the past, but they didn't know the subject existed in a way.
Now, the reason you kind of put me on the spot there. The reason I did ask about that is because I had somebody on the show a while back and asked them about the Bunyip, because I found it really intriguing, and they kind of dismissed it, that it wasn't really, they didn't have enough information about it, or they kind of like dismissed it. But I found it really intriguing because it's such a unique sounding creature. So talk a little bit about the Bunyip, because I always found that.
Well, this is the thing about the Bunyip is, you see, this is, you have to remember, biologically, Australia is not only of the wrong side of the world, so to speak, from where we live, but it's also all the animals are different. It's the continent of marsupials. It's as if evolution took its own way in Australia. And the same is really true of the Bunyip and the mysterious monsters. Now, some of them are which led to the Bunyip was originally an Aborigine term for a mysterious creature, and it was then taken up by the early white settlers to apply to sort of any slightly sort of abnormal thing that they saw. So in a sense, the platypus with its sort of which is such an extraordinary biological creature, a tree that lays eggs and whatever. The problem about it is that that could be in a way described as a bunyip because it's so unusual. But then the thing was that there were continual streams of reports of bunyips from, largely from the countryside of the south, southeast of the country rather, where it's more temperate in a way than the inside, desert conditions are. And it's a bit again like the situation in North America. You get reports in local papers and then they're denied and then a skull is found and it's said to be a diseased calf skull and whatever. It all becomes quite a complicated situation. But I think that because Australia was such an extraordinary country, biologically anyway, it's the country that you would expect to make new discoveries in. And of course, they did. When the first zoologists went to Australia, everywhere they looked, there were new discoveries to be made. Mm. I mean, the kangaroo. What could be more extraordinary than the kangaroo? But if the kangaroos were sort of rarer and more and less easily seen than they are, they would have been seen as a bunyip and would have been probably denied by later people as not having enough information about them. But the same is true. The same is true of New Zealand as well, and maybe into the South Seas generally, where there seem to be certainly not so much lake monsters, but certainly strange marine creatures. And there's a celebrated passage in Thor Heyerdahl's first book about the voyage of the Contiki, where they were simply crossing on their raft from Peru to the islands of Polynesia, and they saw sharks and all these kind of things. But one of their experiences was this great dark mass that arose up underneath the boat, the raft, and then sort of covered a vast area around them and then just sank away. Now, what it could have been, was it some kind of large jellyfish? Was it a coagulated mass or something? What it was? I mean, the sea is full of strange things, and I think this is where we have to be prepared to realize that we simply don't know everything.
Absolutely.
And it's one of those extraordinary things, looking back, scientists sort of say, all the foolish things people believed in the Middle Ages or the 18th century or how advanced science is now. But sometimes you have to remember that the things we know about the past, about from the bestiaries of the Middle Ages or what scientists thought what people thought in the 18th century, these weren't actually thought of by foolish or stupid people. These were the ideas of the leading minds of their day. And now, you know, they like phlogiston, they may be now sort of derided by modern scientists, but I often comfort myself with the thought, God knows, 3 centuries from now, somebody will be sort of talking on whatever form of mass media they have that 3 centuries from now, saying, God, how ignorant those people were back in 2015 that they didn't know this and didn't know that. How advanced we are in our century. You know, I think we've got to be a little more understanding about the past. T.H. White once said, sort of talking about looking back in the past, when he was thinking about the Middle Ages that he wrote about in the Once and Future King, he was sort of saying, well, they're the foolish, the Middle Ages were very foolish, of course, because they devoted their time to building Gothic cathedrals rather than atom bombs. You know, so it all depends on what you want to do and what, you know, that it never does to deride the knowledge of the past, because someday our own knowledge will be the knowledge of the past.
That's very profound. That's absolutely true.
I would discover to be totally inadequate.
Well, it's funny in a way, because we're looking at sort of knowledge of the past, because we're looking at your book, 40 Years Gone By. It's remarkable. It's still, I kind of can see your frustration in a way that we really haven't had that breakthrough that you would expect given how many various lake monster stories there are. I mean, What do you attribute to that?
I mean, I was thinking about this. I mean, for instance, there was a famous sort of effort made to go into sort of Central Africa or West Africa, rather, to search, track down the by Roy Mackel, to search down the Mokele Mbembe, and put it, and you know, one of the celebrated creatures that supposedly lurks in the swamps of those nations. But the problem about it is that really came to nothing. But it just, you know, why go all the way from Chicago to Central Africa or to West Africa when you could just as easily sort of conduct your research in the Great Lakes? And I think I think opportunities to investigate have been neglected. And I think it may be sometimes, I mean, people say, oh, we can't interest academics in it. Now, academic life, and people think, well, academics will have the answer to everything, sort of thing. But, and people have strange ideas about what it is to be a scientist. And people, for instance, about psychic events, they say, oh, there isn't a scientist, you know, scientists say, sort of thing. But you have to remember that very, very few numbers of people who are engaged in scientific work are actually doing very original work.
Mm. Yeah.
If you see a paper in Nature, for instance, there'll be often 40 names at the end of a research article. That everybody who's contributed gets their name attached to it. But the actual possibly is that the numbers of the really breakthrough people are only two or three people. But the way science is funded now means that a lot of people are involved in academic work need to be sure they're going to get their grant for the year or for the research program or
right.
whatever. And you cannot afford as a scientist to put yourself in a position where you look suspect to the people who are going to be funding research. And I think that's one of the reasons why so many scientists and biologists are often disinclined to respond to these situations, because their research lives are limited and short, and they want to get work done, and to get that work done they need to get money, and they don't want to lose the opportunity to do core research by getting themselves involved in something that may make them a laughing stock.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's
so
a difficult.
There's a positive research, a positive resistance in a way to involvement. I mean, I think you can probably see that, although I don't know it quite so well, but the same kind of thing in research into UFOs and whatever.
Oh, absolutely.
Ladies and gentlemen, our special guest speaker will provoke you. He will inspire you. He is Creed Bratton.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Two eyes, two ears, a chin, a mouth, 10 fingers, two nipples, a butt, two kneecaps, a penis. I have just described to you the Loch Ness Monster. And the reward for its capture? All the riches in Scotland. So I have one question. Why are you here?